Public Radio KMXT is supported by a grant from North Pacific Fuel, serving and continuing the tradition of excellent service to the community at three locations: Marine Dock at 715 Shelikoff Street, Gas & Go at the Y, and Gas & Go at Mill Bay.
It's nearly 12 o'clock, and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT. On 100.1 FM, it's your public radio station. We're broadcasting from up here on beautiful Borough Hill, where it's fair skies, 39 degrees, northwest winds 15, gusting to 18. They're calling for mostly sunny skies today, although they're also saying we might see some scattered rain and snow showers, mainly after 4 p.m. West winds to 10. For tonight, scattered rain and snow showers before 7 p.m., then scattered snow showers after that. Partly cloudy skies tonight with a low of 31. Southeast winds, southwest winds to 10. Coming up on the Midday Report, bear activity is up in the city of Kodiak. Also, the second boosters are available here in town. Glen Allen-based Electric Association is looking at small nuclear reactors to help fill in their power grid.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. As Russian forces retreat from parts of Ukraine, the full horror of what has taken place in this war is coming into focus. Corpses in the streets, credible reports of torture, rape, and other atrocities. NPR's Mara Liasson reports President Biden said today that what happened in Bucha, the suburb of the Ukrainian capital, shows that Russian President Vladimir Putin is a war criminal and should be tried as such.
Once again, President Biden is using the toughest language to describe the Russian leader.
This guy is brutal, and what's happening in Bucha is outrageous, and everyone's seen it.
The president's comments come after Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky toured Bucha, where videos show bodies of civilians, some with their hands tied behind their back, lying in the street. Zelensky called the killings genocide and is asking for tougher sanctions. President Biden says the U.S. will continue to provide Ukraine with weapons, ramp up sanctions, and investigate possible war crimes. The U.S. ambassador to the United Nations says the U.S. is also trying to suspend Russia from the top U.N. human rights panel. Mara Liasson, NPR News, The White House.
National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan says the U.S. and allies will announce further economic sanctions on Russia this week. As for the U.S.'s assessment of Russian military movements in Ukraine, Sullivan warns that Russia is now focused on the fight in southern and eastern Ukraine.
We believe that Russia is revising its war aims. Russia is repositioning its forces to concentrate its offensive operations in eastern and parts of southern Ukraine rather than target most of the territory. All indications are that Russia will seek to surround and overwhelm Ukrainian forces in eastern Ukraine.
Sullivan says Russian forces are expected to keep up air and missile strikes across Ukraine to cause military and economic damage. The next stage of this conflict, Sullivan warned, may very well be protracted. Jury selection has begun for the sentencing phase in the trial of the gunman who killed 17 people and wounded 17 at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in 2018. Nicholas Cruz has already pleaded guilty. Here's NPR's Greg Allen.
Judge Elizabeth Scherer told prospective jurors opening statements won't begin until the end of May. The trial is expected to extend through September. Citing vacations, weddings, jobs, and child care responsibilities, many jurors asked to be excused. Once enough eligible jurors are identified, lawyers for both sides will begin questioning them individually. If the defense feels it won't be possible to seat an impartial jury in the county where the mass shooting occurred, it may ask that the trial be moved. The defense will present testimony and evidence that Cruz is mentally impaired and will ask for a life sentence. Prosecutors say the shootings were a premeditated evil act that deserves the death penalty. Greg Allen, NPR News, Fort Lauderdale.
It's NPR.
NPR News es presentada a usted en parte por la Providence Kodiak Island Centro de Asesoramiento. Para una cita o más información, por favor, llama al 907-481-2400.
The Kodiak Police Department has seen a recent uptick in bear activity within city limits. KMXT's Kirsten Dobroth reports.
Bears have been especially active in the residential areas near Thorsheim Street and Hillside Drive, just outside of Kodiak's downtown. That's normal for this time of year as they start coming out of their dens, according to a police spokesperson. Officer Francis De La Fuente said most of their calls have been about bears getting into neighborhood trash and urged residents to be cautious, particularly at night. Leaving out attractants like trash is a violation, and it's dangerous for humans, pets, and bears. Last fall, wildlife officials fatally shot a bear that had gotten into garbage on Salif Lane near Pillar Mountain. That bear was slowly starving because of an intestinal blockage caused by eating trash, according to a final report on the incident received by Kodiak's Fish and Game Office earlier this year. Calls to Kodiak's police department about bear incidents are automatically reported to Alaska wildlife troopers and local fish and game officials. They confirmed that Kodiak's bear season has begun. In Kodiak, I'm Kirsten Dobrath.
Older Kodiak residents are now eligible for their second COVID-19 booster shots. Last week, the federal government authorized shots for people 50 and older. It's also available for those who are immunocompromised. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention also updated their guidance following the FDA's announcement. It now recommends a fourth shot of the Pfizer or Moderna vaccines for anyone eligible who received their first booster at least 4 months ago. Safeway Pharmacy on Mill Bay Road is offering second boosters on a walk-in basis from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. daily. Anyone interested will need to bring their COVID-19 vaccination card with them. The Kodiak Area Native Association's Health Clinic is also offering a further round of boosters Monday through Friday. It's by appointment only. Call them at 907-486-9870 to schedule an appointment. The Southeast Conference is proposing a pilot project using wood pellets as an alternative energy source in Ketchikan. The regional civic and business organization has already secured a $1 million grant from the federal government for the concept under the Southeast Alaska Sustainability Strategy. Ketchikan's Gravina Island could be a prime site for the effort, says Executive Director Robert Venables. He says the borough owns a roughly 5-acre parcel that could one day produce wood pellets as an alternative to heating oil. There's financial assistance available to Alaska homeowners impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic, but the deadline is today. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation plans to distribute $50 million to Alaska homeowners to help with mortgage payments, repaying past due property taxes, utility payments, or other household expenses. The funds come from the American Rescue Plan Act passed by Congress last year. AHFC spokesperson Stacy Barnes says the assistance is limited to homeowners who live in the state. She went on to say the program has already received more than 8,000 applicants. The program is similar to one run last year by AHFC, which distributed more than $250 million in rental and utility assistance to tens of thousands of Alaska tenants. Homeowner applications are due by the end of the day today. Homeowners can check their eligibility or find out more information at alaskahousingrelief.org. Utilities along Alaska's rail belt could soon be united under one umbrella organization. Representatives from all five rail belt utilities and other stakeholders submitted an application Friday to the state's regulatory agency to be that group, or Electric Reliability Organization, which would oversee a joint set of standards and coordinate project planning between co-ops from Homer to Fairbanks. The application was submitted 7 years after the agency highlighted the need for more coordination among utilities. KDLL's Sabine Pooks has more.
David Thomas says it's kind of like putting together a book of rules for the road. Thomas is the director of strategic services for Homer Electric Association. He's also the cooperative's representative to the group that applied, called the Rail Belt Reliability Council.
So these new rules, more comprehensive, now mandatory and with penalties, and covering the wider range of participants in the future.
Formal coordination among utilities is a new concept in Alaska. The Regulatory Commission of Alaska oversees public utilities rates and approves contracts, but it doesn't oversee some of the more technical rules of the road. And right now, a lot of those rules are informal agreements between utilities. There are also no enforcement mechanisms to hold utilities accountable to those standards. The RCA took issue with that lack of structure, and in 2015, it sent a letter to lawmakers outlining the need for reform on the rail belt, pointing to inefficiencies in projects that spanned service areas and disjointed reliability standards. And at the same time, the energy landscape in Alaska has become a lot more complicated. There are more players today than there were before, like independent power producers, private companies that sell electricity to cooperatives. And Thomas says there are more complicated factors at play also, like threats to utilities' cybersecurity.
We are perhaps only as secure as our weakest link. There are physical and cybersecurity standards that we currently follow on a voluntary basis, which will become more detailed and will become mandatory in the future.
In 2020, the Alaska legislature passed a bill to pave the way for the existence of a rail belt-wide organization. And that's when the Rail Belt Reliability Council started meeting. The group's made up of representatives from utilities like HEA, as well as representatives from private companies in the state. Julie Esty, with Matanuska Electric Association, chairs the group. She says it had its first meeting in July 2020.
And since then, we've been working to put together things like bylaws and processes and governance structures, so it's been quite an effort.
That's not to say all members of the council agreed every step of the way. Some members came to the table with fundamentally different interests, which Thomas says is why the application sometimes goes into excruciating detail about the intricacies of the cooperative efforts. No group wanted to be left out.
There was heartfelt discussion, frequent arm wrestling, and occasional mediation to get to the end point of having a unanimous agreement to submit the application.
20 months after the group first started meeting and 300 pages of application materials later, it submitted its roadmap for rail belt-wide cooperation to the RCA. And now the commission has 6 months to review the group's application to be the coordinating force. Esty says she's not aware of any other applications that will be submitted. She says the rules are one part of the equation. The organization will also work on coming up with a plan for how utilities can meet their load's needs.
So all of these things are common in the lower 48. Because our system didn't require it until now, you know, it's been more informal, but all of those processes will be formalized so we can really be a cohesive group in how we, not necessarily manage, but in how we grow and what it looks like.
Thomas says the co-ops are footing the bill to pay for research and hire staff. He estimates a $500,000 price tag for HEA in 2023 and roughly $1 million each year after that. He says one way to pay for that would be a line item on ratepayers' bills, estimating an extra dollar a month for the average household.
Could draw an analogy that hiring a police force and having a court system to enforce the rules of the road is not free, but hopefully ensures a uniform playing field, fairness, and encourages more people to play by the rules than if those systems weren't in place.
He says the direct financial benefit to ratepayers is difficult to quantify, but the hope is that developing a roadmap for the utilities could help with economies of scale. And if they're all putting their heads together, they might be able to work on larger, more ambitious projects down the road. In Kenai, I'm Sabine Pooks.
Glen Allen-based Copper Valley Electric Association is studying the feasibility of using a new type of small nuclear reactor to help generate power for its 3,800 customers. KUAC's Tim Ellis has this report.
Copper Valley Electric Association relies on inexpensive hydropower during the warmer months of the year, but in the winter, the utility must switch to more costly oil-fired power generation. And Copper Valley Chief Executive Travis Million says the utility has, for years, been trying to find a cheaper and greener alternative to its diesel and naphtha-fueled generators.
There's no predictability of the cost. Just this year alone, between December and January, we saw a 44% price increase on our diesel fuel that we use for power generation.
Million says Copper Valley's board adopted a policy last year to reduce the utility's greenhouse gas emissions, so co-op staff studied wind, solar, and other renewables. But they found none would reliably generate electricity in the winter, and regardless, they'd have to be backed up by the expensive liquid fuel-fired generators. So they turned to nuclear-powered generation.
The technology, you know, has been there for a long time, but there just hadn't been a way to manufacture these type of reactors.
Specifically, micro-modular reactors, small self-contained and self-operating reactor systems built into two 40-foot structures that can be brought onto a site and replaced every 20 years for refueling. The 10-megawatt facility that Copper Valley is considering would be similar to the 5-megawatt micro-reactor that's scheduled to begin operating on Eielson Air Force Base in 2027.
With the advanced manufacturing technologies that are out there today, it now makes it feasible to where they can mass produce, you know, these type of smaller scale reactors.
Million says after studying the industry, Copper Valley began working with Seattle-based UltraSafe Nuclear Corporation. Company officials came to Alaska last summer to survey the co-op's facilities and service area, which includes the Copper River Valley and areas along the Richardson Highway from Valdez to Glen Allen and the Glen Highway to the Mat-Su boundary. The company's now working with the utility on a feasibility study that'll be completed in July, when the co-op's board will decide whether to move ahead on the project. And he says, so far, it looks promising.
This could be possibly the answer that we've been looking for decades, a generation source that is a stable, cost-efficient way to produce electricity.
Million says he hopes the study will show that the microreactor will help keep the cost of electricity down to somewhere around 20 to 25 cents per kilowatt hour. He estimates a facility would cost $80 to $100 million to build, which compares favorably to the University of Alaska Fairbanks' $245 million 17-megawatt coal-fired power plant that went online in 2018. And Million says the federal infrastructure bill could help pay for the co-op's microreactor.
There was $2.4 billion for demonstration projects for advanced nuclear reactors.
So there's a lot of interest out there over Copper Valley's proposal, especially in the utility industry.
We're really excited to be able to follow the progress that's happening in Eielson and Copper River.
Meadow Bailey is a spokesperson for Golden Valley Electric Association.
So very exciting technology. And if it ends up being something that is safe and reliable and cost effective, and then in the future, it's definitely something we would consider as an option.
If Copper Valley's board decides to move ahead on the project, it would be Alaska's first commercial nuclear-powered electrical generating station. Two others were proposed in recent decades, one for Galena and the other for Esther near Fairbanks, but neither panned out. And the Army built a nuclear power plant on Fort Greely that operated for about 10 years before it was shut down in 1972. In Delta Junction, I'm Tim Ellis.
Officials with the U.S. Department of Agriculture announced nearly $9 million in grants on Thursday for 25 different projects across southeast Alaska. The grants are intended to be an early step in a long-term commitment to foster lots of sustainable economic activities driven by locals. Their support for indigenous culture programs, seaweed and shellfish farming, timber management, and more. KTOO's Jeremy Shea has this report.
A small crowd of federal bureaucrats and representatives of Southeast Alaska organizations celebrates the signing of an agreement in Juneau. It establishes a permanent team made up of U.S. Department of Agriculture officials who will work on sustainability goals in Southeast Alaska. There's also a new permanent position tied to the team.
Yeah, I'm Barb Miranda and I'm the SAS coordinator.
SAS stands for Southeast Alaska Sustainability Strategy. For now, that's a unique thing. The USDA doesn't have other sustainability strategies for other parts of the country. Miranda says in the past, tribes, local governments, or other organizations in Southeast had to shoehorn their needs into existing federal programming. This new strategy has meant getting several different USDA agencies working together and listening to local needs.
This is different. We asked for input from our local organizations and received it. And now the federal agencies, we're doing the work to struggle to fit those into our agency authorities. The shoe's on the other foot with this.
Miranda is based in Juneau, and until about a week and a half ago was the director of the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center, which the Forest Service runs. She's also a former mayor of Gustavus, so she's been on both sides of the table. The USDA announced it was working on the strategy last July, along with a commitment to invest $25 million in Southeast Alaska. It complements the Biden administration's efforts to end large-scale, old-growth timber harvesting in the Tongass National Forest and a renewed effort to limit new roads in the Tongass. Alaska's congressional delegation opposes the roadless rule in the Tongass because they say it squelches economic activity and gets in the way of local stewardship. The delegation could not immediately be reached for comment about the latest developments. Xochitl Torres-Small is the USDA's Undersecretary for Rural Development. She says those changes were part of why Southeast Alaska is getting special attention.
And so as you look at the changes in the timber industry, not strictly the roadless rule, but you look at court decisions and you look at impact in terms of the challenges the timber industry faces now, combined with people who are responding to that by working more collaboratively together, by coming up with new ideas for how to invest in the home that they love, that's something you want to invest in. That's something that rural development, that's something that USDA wants to be a part of.
Torres Small says the lessons the agencies learned in Southeast Alaska could be applied in other parts of the country.
At this time, this is really a pilot. We're forging new ground here.
USDA officials say they're working on getting another $16 million in sustainability grants to Southeast Alaska in the next 6 months or so. In Juneau, I'm Jeremy Shea.
KMXT Local News is underwritten in part by
GCI. GCI has adjusted store hours across the state to keep our customers and employees as safe as possible during this time. The most up-to-date store hours are available on GCI.com.
Read diverse, read indie on Insight Daily Radio. Conversations with today's most influential authors from the world of independent publishing. Denise Lajmadeer is a Native American author, and her latest book is entitled His Feathers Were Chains, an award-winning poetry collection addressing trauma, love, grief, and enduring hope. While the premise of the collection is overt criticism of settler society, the poetry within is subtle, approachable, and grounded in Ojibwe knowledge and customs. We spoke with her about this most interesting book.
I was born on the Turtle Mountain Reservation in Belcourt, North Dakota. And my family relocated to Portland, Oregon during the mid-50s. So then I returned to North Dakota in the early 70s. And I've been writing poetry since I was 10 years old. I took creative writing classes in high school. But in 1968, 1969, there were no Native writers. I had no mentors or no role models. So in my mind, I thought, well, Indians just don't write or they can't write. Then in 1984, I came across a book titled Love Medicine. And not only was the writer Native and female, but she was from my home reservation. She was from the Turtle Mountains. And of course, that was Louise Erdrich. She ended up coming to the Turtle Mountains with her sister Hyde Erdrich and doing some workshops. And I gave her some of my scraps of poems and poems I've been writing since the 1970s. She read my poems and she took me outside by a burr oak tree in the Turtle Mountains there, and she looked at me and she said, Denise, you can write.
That's author Denise Lajmadeer on her latest collection of poetry, His Feathers Were Chains, published by North Dakota State University Press. Read Diverse, Read Indie is presented by the Independent Book Publishers Association.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Welcome to your Island Messenger for Monday. It is the fourth day of April, the year 2022. The sun rose today at 7:28. It will set again at 8:57. That will give us 13 hours and 29 minutes of daylight, a gain of 4 minutes and 59 seconds compared to yesterday. Our record low for this date was 12 degrees, set in 1949, and our record high was 54, set in 1941. Currently 39 degrees out at the airport under fair skies with northwest winds 15 gusting to 18. Looking at our local tides, we have a high tide coming up at 5:04 this afternoon here on the east side. That'll be a 7-foot tide, followed by a low tide at 10:34 tonight of 1.8-foot tide. Our next high tide will be at 4:44 a.m. on the fourth day of the fourth month, and that tide will be 8.8 feet. The next low tide will be at 11:22 a.m. tomorrow morning and be a 0-foot tide here on the east side. Over on the west side, you have a high tide coming up at 5:24 this afternoon. That will be a 12.4-foot tide in Larsen Bay, followed by a low tide at 11:14 p.m. of 2.5 feet. Your next high tide will be at 5:13 a.m., a 14-foot tide, and your low tide for tomorrow before noon on the west side will be at 11:50 a.m. and be minus 2/10 of a foot. Mariners, we do have small craft advisories on both sides of the island. From Marmot Island to Sitkanek, small craft advisory through Tuesday, west winds to 25 knots and seas to 12 feet today. For tomorrow, southwest 20, seas to 10 feet. Over in the Shelikof Strait, small craft advisory through tonight. Southwest 25 tonight, seas to 5 feet. For tomorrow, southwest 20, seas to 4 feet. The Board of Education will be having a work session immediately followed by a special meeting tonight at 6:30 p.m. in the District Services Conference Room. That's F-140 of the old high school wing. The meeting will also be streamed through BlueJeans, and meeting login information is posted on the Kodiak Island Borough School District's website. Look under the Board of Education tab. Items on the special meeting agenda include an executive session to discuss personnel and legal matters, the 2022-23 certificated contracts, and the 2022-23 administrator contract. For more information, contact Bianca Clark, Secretary of the Board of Education, at 907-486-7566. And the meeting agendas and packets can be viewed on Board Docs on the Kodiak Island Borough School District's website. The Kodiak History Museum is relaunching their temporary exhibit program, and they're looking for proposals for future exhibits. Is there a story you think is not talked about enough, or a topic or issue you'd like to see explored? They're accepting exhibit proposals for their new exhibit opening in August of 22. Proposals must be submitted by May 1st. For more information about how to propose an exhibit, contact Lynn Walker, who is the curator, at curator@kodiakhistorymuseum.org, or visit the Kodiak History Museum's website. That can be found at www.kodiakhistorymuseum.org. Tomorrow, the Women's Bay Service Area Board will be having their regular meeting. That's happening in the Women's Bay Fire Hall at 5:30 p.m. Also tomorrow, Fire Protection Area Number 1 will be having their regular meeting. That's happening at the Bayside Fire Hall at 6 p.m. tomorrow. And on Thursday, the Assembly will be having their regular meeting. That will be happening at 6:30 p.m. in the Assembly Chambers. Senior Citizens of Kodiak has enough bags for now. They'd like to thank everybody who has been dropping off bags. St. Herman's Sisterhood's Easter Bake Sale is coming up next Saturday. That's happening at the Orthodox Cathedral at 385 Kashabarov Circle. Again, that's next Saturday at 11 a.m. They are requesting no early birds, please. It's not a yard sale. They are featuring Russian Easter bread, kulik pirog, potato salad, cakes, pies, cookies, and more. The Spanish pastry making class is coming up via Zoom. It's happening Thursday, April 14th from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. And you can learn to make grandma's Spanish pastry recipe just in time for springtime brunches. It can also be made deliciously vegan and gluten-free. Friends and family will never know the difference. Follow along at home, then enjoy your delectable dish. Again, that is Thursday, April 14th from 6 to 8 p.m. The class is via Zoom. The instructor will be Jocelyn Keys. And to register, you just need to go to kodiakcollege.asapconnected.com. Well, I have some sad news for tonight. The Monday night trivia game at the library has been canceled. I know a lot of people look forward to that. I'm sure they'll be back next week. The week of April 4th through 9th is National Library Week. Come celebrate all the library has to offer during Library Week. Whether you're in need of a good book, a new movie, or a quiet place to study, the library has something for everyone. Also, Thursday, April 7th at 3:30 p.m. is the library's next chess club meeting. Drop in to learn, practice, or sharpen your chess skills in a cozy, friendly environment. No experience is necessary, and it's open to all ages. On Saturday, April 9th from 11:30 to 12 p.m. and again at 2 to 3 p.m., Hot Wheels, the wheelchair-bound bunny, will be at the library for a meet and greet. Learn about how this bunny has inspired children around Kodiak and beyond. Kids will hear about creative problem solving, resilience, and compassion for children 6 years older and their families. Registration is required as space is limited. And again, that's Saturday, April 9th, two times, 11 to 12 p.m. and 2 to 3 p.m.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT two times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m. and during the midday report at 12:20. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.